Picture this. It is almost 11 at night and your essay is due tomorrow. You open an AI chatbot, and in seconds, it hands you an outline, a thesis, 3 examples, and a sentence that sounds smarter than anything you were about to write. It feels like help. It might even feel like a tutor sitting right beside you. But a harder question is hiding underneath. Did the AI help you learn, or did it quietly do the thinking for you? In that moment, it may look like a lifeline. To a learning scientist, it is where the whole future of school is being decided. Hello, and welcome to Teen Scientist. I am Arya Shyam, your host on WDIY, with James Ziprot running audio tonight. On Teen Scientist, we take the questions that make you stop and think, and follow them into the science behind the world we are living in, and the future we are heading toward. Tonight's question is that late-night decision. Can AI help you learn, or is it just finishing your homework? And later, the part that reaches way past one assignment. AI may be testing not just students, but whether schools themselves can change fast enough without losing what learning is for. My guest is Dr. Justin Reich, director of the MIT Teaching Systems Lab and a professor at MIT who studies how new technology actually lands in real classrooms, and a former high school teacher himself. Dr. Reich, thank you so much for joining us. Before we dive in, could you introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little about your work?
Sure. My name is Justin Reich. I'm a faculty member at MIT. I study online learning and how schools use technology and how teachers learn. And I'm a former ninth grade world history teacher.
Most conversations about AI in school happen at the level of headlines and policy. I want to start somewhere smaller and more honest, the moment a student is actually sitting there with it late at night. So if it's late at night and a student opens an AI chatbot for homework, in that moment, what do you think is really happening? Is it learning help, a shortcut, or both?
Yeah, so we interviewed 120 teachers and students across the country. And I would say in the moment it sounds like you're describing a moment where it's late at night, the student is running out of time, the student wants to go to bed. And in those circumstances, it's pretty likely that a student using AI is using it to bypass learning, that they're not spending a lot of extra time late at night, having done the work themselves, having a conversation with a chatbot to learn more or to get a new perspective. They've probably said something like, it's too late. I can't figure this out. I'll just ask the machine to give me an answer and then maybe I'll change it. Maybe I'll humanize it in some way or something like that. But there's a lot of bypassing learning that's going on.
I see. And underneath that moment is one distinction that students wrestle with all the time. And here's a question that many students are asking. Where is the line between using AI as a tutor and using it as a shortcut?
I don't think we know. For lots of questions as it relates to large language models and learning, one of the most important places to start is by acknowledging how little we know and how little we understand about this new phenomenon. But generally speaking, when students are doing the work, doing the thinking, leading the conversation themselves, they're maybe more likely to be getting better learning results. When they're asking questions, where they're asking machines to give them drafts, to give them examples, to give them pieces, that's when they're less likely to be doing the learning on their own. To date, some things are clear. It's clear that if a student turns over their thinking to the machine, if they say, here's a homework assignment I got, give me a draft of that, they're very unlikely to be learning anything. In cases in which folks are interacting and they're not having the machine do the whole assignment, but they're just getting part of it or getting help, you know, we're probably more suspicious of things like, you know, give me a draft, give me a first example, show me what another step is, show me what the next step could look like. The one problem with the machines is that they're too helpful. They give too much stuff away. It takes a pretty disciplined person to approach a large language model with a task and to say, make sure I'm doing the whole task myself. Just give me pointers, give me feedback, give me suggestions. In part, because in a lot of cases, that kind of learning where you're not only doing the productive struggle yourself, but getting a machine to do extra productive struggle with you is just going to take longer and take more time. And I don't know, like, your experience with your peers, but there are, like, generally speaking, young people are not looking for ways to have their homework take longer.
Right, yeah. Now, there's also something about these tools that makes the judgment harder, as they are not consistent from one task to the next. And your work talks about AI's jagged frontier. It can be amazing at one task and confidently wrong on a similar one. Why does that make it so hard for students and teachers?
So the feature you're describing is that large language models like ChatGPT, they have what scientists have called a jagged frontier, which, as you say, on very similar tasks, it's not just on one task they'll perform well, on another similar task they'll perform poorly, but you can actually ask them to do the same task multiple times, and some of their responses will be good and some of them will be lousy. How do people tell the difference between a really novel, thoughtful, interesting, useful idea from a machine and a misguided, factually incorrect, insane idea from a machine? Well, you have to be an expert in the domain. The main thing that lets you tell the difference between a good output and a bad output is not some kind of AI literacy. It's not some kind of understanding of large language models. It's what you know about the domain. So if you were a really good plumber, and you were thinking, like, man, I've got this really small utility closet I'm trying to plumb. What would be a good way to fit all the stuff my client wants in there? You know, give me 4 suggestions, ChatGPT. If you're a plumber and GPT comes up with 4 suggestions, you can probably be like, oh, 3 of those won't work at all. That's a terrible idea. Yeah. But this 4th one, actually, I hadn't thought of that. That's a pretty good idea. If you're not an expert plumber and you ask ChatGPT a plumbing question, you really have no idea whether the ideas are all that good or not. So when you apply this kind of reasoning to schools, the problem you run into pretty quickly is that the reason why young people are in schools is they're novices. They're new at this stuff. Typically, they're learning a domain because they can't tell the difference between an expert response and a novice response. Right. If they could tell the difference between an expert response and novice response, we wouldn't be making them take calculus or reading Catcher in the Rye or whatever it is. And so, you know, the same is also true, by the way, for teachers. We've interviewed many teachers, and when you interview expert teachers about how they're using artificial intelligence to enhance their instruction, they usually say things like, I'm looking for this very particular kind of learning activity, and I know that this framework works with my students, so I want you to think about this framework, my students, and it has to have these characteristics. And then the machine gives some examples and the expert teacher can go, oh, that is a good version of the thing that I want. Thank you for helping me make that. And we heard a terrible story of brand new first year teachers in a district where the mentoring program had been canceled for lack of funding, that they weren't giving extra compensation to expert teachers for helping new teachers get started on the job. And so a bunch of the new teachers were using ChatGPT to write their lesson plans. It's much less likely that that's going to be a successful effort because a brand new teacher has no idea what a good lesson plan is. Yeah. So that, you know, understanding that feature, the sort of uneven performance, helps explain why there are particular risks in having novices use these tools.
Before we get to what schools should do about any of this, it is worth asking why students reach for AI in the first place. When students told you why they turned to AI to get schoolwork done, what did you hear underneath just the simple word cheating?
Yeah, all kinds. I mean, some students are very clear with us that they're just cheating. In fact, you know, we had one student we interviewed, Leandro, who said that in senior year, he just did all of his work with ChatGPT. And we asked him, you know, what should teachers do? And he said, well, the teachers should learn how to use detectors or figure out how to catch students or cheating. And, you know, and the interviewer was like, but Leandro, then you would have gotten caught. And he said, yeah, I wish I'd been caught. That, one of the things we know about adolescents is that they're boundary pushers. That is like a super normal part of adolescence, which is to figure out which rules you can break and which you can't and sort of how far you can push boundaries. And it's really important for adolescent development, not that all of you and all of your listeners like this every time, but it's really important for adolescent development that they find those boundaries. Finding what those boundaries is what helps them learn what the rules are, feel safe, know how to be part of a community, things like that. So some of it really is just cheating. But we had interviews with students who told us that, you know, one student said, she was in an international baccalaureate program, and she was super excited about this theory of knowledge capstone class that she was taking. And she loved working on her theory of knowledge project so much that she was using ChatGPT to do the assignments in her other classes. She was like, there's one piece of homework that I really want to do, and to have more time, I'm going to have machines do my other homework. You know, we talked with one student who was a writer who just felt really stuck and went to her teacher and said, you know, can I use an LLM to help me think through this plot point in my story and come up with some different examples in talking together? They're like, yeah, that, you know, seems like a good thing to try. And there are other things that student could have, like students have gotten stuck with their writing for hundreds of years, and they've, you know, brainstormed in journals, and they've talked with their peers and other things like that. Definitely, I mean, the most canonical case is probably the one that you described at the beginning, where students, as per usual, as they have for hundreds of years, don't give themselves enough time to do assignments. It gets late at night, they're feeling kind of stuck, and they just ask the machine to do the work for them. But, you know, more and more, there's evidence that A, that is happening more and more with students who are younger and younger, and it's having negative repercussions on students' learning. There are certainly young people out there who are using LLMs in other kinds of responsible ways. You know, my daughter took a tough biology class this year, and she did a ton of taking notes by hand, and then she would type up those notes into online tools like Blockit to make herself quizzes, and then she would upload the notes to Notebook LLM to have it make a podcast that she could listen to. And she asked me what I thought about that, and the main thing I explained to her is, like, listening to the podcast, probably not that helpful, but if you enjoy it, go ahead. What was really worthwhile was you taking the time to put together all those notes and then to think about what ought to go into that podcast. You know, she once asked me, her friends were asking her to get copies of the podcast, and sort of inadvertently I upset her because I said, well, you can share it with them, but it's not going to be very helpful. And then she had this terrible moral quandary, which is her friends wanted her study podcasts, and her dad had told her that it wouldn't be helpful. But I explained to her, well, you know, you can go ahead and share it. It's their responsibility to decide whether and how to study. But the important thing is building the study materials, not sort of passively listening to them.
Students were not the only ones caught off guard, and schools were too. And you have a specific name for the way this technology arrived. You call generative AI arrival technology. It showed up in schools before anyone was ready. In plain language, what does that mean, and why are schools struggling to keep up?
So historically, most education technologies have been adopted. Your school has probably an IT director. They may even have a small group like called a technology committee or something. Yeah. And when new technologies come along that schools are interested in, you know, the learning management system, a student information system, smart boards, tablets, whatever it is, usually the only way those things can get into schools is if a small group of people get together and go, like, would it be a good idea to buy these things? I don't know. Let's buy six of them and put them in six classrooms and see if they're helpful. And we'll run a little pilot. And if things work well, we'll buy more of them. There's a process that people in municipal government and other places call procurement. And through this procurement process, there's a way in which ideally schools are intentionally thinking about things like, what are our learning goals for our students? What are our priorities? Where do we want to spend our money? Another question is this a thing we want to do right now? You know, when smart boards first came out, there were lots of schools that were like, I don't know if that's any good. Let's wait and see. And it turns out that the ones that waited and never bought smart boards really benefited because smart boards basically were a total waste of money. There's sort of no evidence at all that they increased learning in any way. And if you were a school that waited 5 or 6 years to sort of watch this play out, you could be like, oh, great. Glad we didn't, you know, get involved in that fad. Wasn't that helpful? ChatGPT, as of November of 2022, pretty much arrived on every student's phone and every teacher's laptop simultaneously. And so it started being incorporated into the practice of schools without that adoption committee, without that procurement process, without that intention. We had a really funny story of a teacher who had come back from maternity leave, and she was walking around her classroom. This was maybe in 2023, and all of her students were using the Bing browser. And she just thought this was totally baffling. Like, Bing is the thing that you use to download Chrome so that you never have to use Bing again. But then she eventually realized that all of her students were on the Bing browser, because for a while Copilot was free, and you could get free access to ChatGPT if you use the Bing browser. And so her students were using it to do in-class assignments and to do their homework and things like that. You know, so like that's not happening because the school has some kind of intentional process. It's because students discovered a tool that they were interested in using. And, you know, nobody told this teacher that it had arrived in school. We don't really know, as educational researchers, how to deal with arrival technologies. We sort of have ideas about what an adoption process should look like and how you incorporate things and how you pilot them and how you evaluate them. But we don't have good playbooks for what to do when Silicon Valley releases technologies that are very rapidly taken up by students and teachers.
And if new rules alone cannot solve this, the next place to look is the work itself and the assignment teachers give. How could teachers redesign assignments when students can get instant help from AI so the thinking still actually happens?
Again, the most important place to start is we do not know. It's 3.5 years, almost 4 years after the development, the release of ChatGPT 3.5. And that question is really important. And we do not know the answer to it. We know some things that people are trying, but knowing what people are trying is not the same as knowing what works. You know, here are a few different strategies that we know of. Some people are saying, look, you just have to assume that students are using the machines in any circumstance they can. And so if you want to test their ability without the machines, you just have to not give them access to computers. You have to, you know, have them do things in blue books, on pencil and paper, other things like that. Actually, at MIT, where I teach, many of our classes have sort of had that philosophy for a long time. Like, our students are very enterprising and very talented with computers. And, you know, even in the computer science departments, many exams would have taken place by pencil and paper, just because we want to evaluate what students know about computer science. And if we give them computers, then we're evaluating what they can look up about computer science. And that's maybe not, it could be a useful thing, but maybe not nearly as helpful. A second thing that some faculty are trying is to build assignments where either the difficulty goes up or you're redesigning things expecting students will use machines. Sometimes this works, and there's some neat, promising examples with this. But you know, some of the very best, you know, progressive educators who've been doing project-based learning, student-centered learning, incorporating technology for a really long time are still saying, man, when we try to do this, we still see machines doing too much of the work. You know, similarly, actually, there are also problems with giving students blue books. Like, it doesn't seem super realistic to have the only evaluation of students in a computer science program to be what they can write down on a piece of paper. Like, there's parts of that that don't make sense either. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a range of things that people are testing. The most important thing that can happen in the education system right now, which unfortunately is not happening nearly enough, is evaluating these different kinds of approaches. And this can happen with the local educators, the local teachers, the local administrators, students and families, like in your school. You know, there are probably some teachers in your school that are trying more of the back to basics, back to blue books kind of approach. And we can evaluate how well students like that, how well families like that, how student performance on important measures of learning compares this year to previous years. You probably have other teachers in your school that are trying really AI forward approaches. Some of them are probably working, some of them are probably not. The best way that educators can evaluate any of these kinds of new experiments is by looking really closely at student work. In most cases, teachers are not completely changing their assignments. Like, if you did, you know, a fetal pig dissection in 2026, you also probably did one in 2017. And you can actually take the lab reports. You can take lab reports that you assigned from 2017 before students had any access to ChatGPT and compare them to whatever modifications you made to try to use AI or restrict AI in 2026 and say, all right, well, how is this working? Am I getting the kinds of evidence of learning that I wanted to see, regardless of the time period, in 2026 compared to how I did in the past? And if you're seeing less learning, more homogeneity, you know, less content coverage, other kind, then you can say, okay, this is a problem that we have to adjust. And in some cases, you might say, wow, you know, when I give students these extra tools, the things that they're creating are more creative and more interesting and more successful, and then you can move forward with those approaches.
Based on the like teachers trying different approaches, what does it mean for a school to iterate, like to try small experiments instead of chasing just one giant perfect solution?
Yeah, there won't be like the one thing to do to change your assignments. One thing that's almost miraculous about schools is how incredibly multifaceted they are. You know, so like stop one day in late September when your school is back up and running and think about all the things that students are learning that day in your school system. Like there's a preschooler learning how to tie their shoes, and there's a kindergartner learning how to write the letters of the alphabet, and there's a sophomore who's learning how to conjugate Spanish verbs, and there's a senior who's learning calculus. You know, we teach kids, you know, how to have safe sex or how to abstain from sex. We teach them how to obey authority. We teach them how to participate in civil disobedience. We teach them just this like unbelievable range of things. And all of them require different pedagogical approaches to some extent. Because they require different pedagogical approaches, there's not going to be like one solution to these problems. Teachers also have an intuition, and schools have an intuition, that they have to try solutions in big chunks. They say, like, we need to have an AI policy for 2026, 2027. That might be good, but if you don't know what a good AI policy is, you may not actually want to build one for all of 2026, 2027. You might want to try some things for one marking period. You know, we're going to do this set of rules. We're going to try this approach from September 1st to, you know, November 1st. And then we're going to reevaluate. When teachers are redesigning their assignments, they don't have to redesign a whole year's worth of assignments. They don't even have to give all of their students a redesigned assignment. You could, you know, create what you think is a test assignment and ask two kids who are really interested in the class, or just two kids who need some extra credit, or two kids who are willing to stay after school for some pizza, to try your new assignment. And then if that thing is kind of working, you can try it with one class and then all your classes, and then use it repeatedly throughout the semester, over the year, things like that. In industry, in research, one of the ways that we think about making fast progress is by trying to make lots of small, falsifiable bets quickly. We say, let's try a thing, let's get it in front of people, let's get it under experimental conditions, you know, not over the course of a semester, but in a week, in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks. And when we try things, let's gather some evidence about whether it's working and whether it's not. If it's not working, it's easy to throw away because we've only invested a week into it. And if it is working, then we can try another version of it that's a little bigger, that's a little deeper, that's a little more invested, and improve that way. So I have this book I wrote called Iterate, The Secret to Innovation in Schools, which has a bunch of these ideas and sort of specific protocols, specific practices for helping schools try new things when they're navigating uncertainty.
Now, so real change in schools tends to look slow and unglamorous. What role should students have in shaping these AI rules instead of just receiving them?
I mean, in my classroom, sort of everything we do with AI so far has been negotiated with students. I ask them all the time, what do you think we should try? How do you think this will work? What do you think a new assignment looks like? I'll say, I'm thinking about three different ways of doing this assignment. You know, should I let you each choose? Should I make you all do it together? I guess one thing that is shifting sort of in my fourth year of messing around with this stuff is I now have some experience in the teaching my classes that they don't have, because I've done this a bunch of times and I have a better sense of like, what are the dead ends, where students will make mistakes, make bad decisions, embarrass themselves, you know, using tools that give them bad information or bad insights or things like that. But just, I think every educator in their own classroom can be sort of having an ongoing engagement. And then historically, you know, student tech teams have been very successful in many schools doing a wide range of things, helping to set policy, helping to provide professional development, helping give a sense of youth perspective. You know, where I live in Massachusetts, when tablets were first introduced and Wi-Fi was becoming more common in schools, the Burlington High School made a student tech team. And when they first were created, they would like you could, you know, send them a text message and they'd come in your classroom and replace your projector bulb or fix, you know, troubleshoot a problem. But eventually they set up a kind of like Apple Genius Bar where you could sign up for slots and a teacher would say, like, I want to be able to do this kind of thing. And a student would say, oh, well, this kind of technology, this kind of approach might be a neat way of doing this. So sort of students had a bunch of technological expertise and teachers had pedagogical expertise and they found ways to partner.
Now, I want to bring this back down to one student and a worry a lot of them have. What would you say to a student who wants to use technology honestly, but does not want to fall behind classmates who are using it heavily?
Man, that is really hard. And that is a problem that, you know, we know many students are concerned about. We also, you know, kind of shockingly understand that students are really concerned about what large language models might do negatively to their learning. I mean, if you go back and look at youth surveys of almost any generation of technology, cell phones, tablets, computers in the classroom, the web, they're like generally enthusiastic about it. But, you know, in December of 2025, there was a survey that 2/3 of teens thought that AI was going to harm critical thinking. I mean, one thing to meditate on is the risks of having the machine do the work for you. There are increasingly stories of students who get really far in a class, really far into a program, depending too much on machines, and they don't learn what they need to learn, and then they kind of fall behind unrecoverably. There was a long story posted by a professor in the UC system who had a junior who's doing a sort of specialized computer science internship as part of his major. And the professor realized the student actually had no idea not only how to code, but like how code even worked. Wow. You know, this was a junior computer science major who was basically like hopelessly behind in the basic understanding of his field. And so those are some real risks that are out there. I mean, hopefully too, as much as you can, the goal in life is not to race with your classmates and it's not to be ahead or behind. You know, the goal in life is to do things that feel meaningful to you, are of service to others, and help you build really good relationships with your neighbors, your family, with people that you love. And racing ahead is usually not the way to accomplish any of those things. I know that's hard in competitive schools and, you know, start thinking about colleges and things like that. But really, like, in the end, unless there's like some very specialized competitive thing you're really sure that you want to do, you probably can get away with like a perfectly happy, meaningful life, you know, really pursuing like a good education that's meaningful to you.
It is late, the essay is still due, and the chatbot is right there. But the real question was never, will I get caught? It is, am I doing the thinking or skipping it? Dr. Reich, thank you so much for joining me on Teen Scientist and for showing us that the future of learning depends less on the tool and more on the choice in front of it. And thank you for listening to Teen Scientist. I am Arya Shyam. Until next time, stop, think, and ask why.